Aloha. It's Tuesday, May 13th. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The careers of transgender military personnel are on the line. Shades of don't ask, don't tell. The U.S. has temporarily reduced tariffs on Chinese products while negotiations continue. What does all the uncertainty mean for small businesses in Chinatown? And the federal government withdrew funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, affecting nonprofit groups across the country. We learn more about who's been affected in Hawaii. And we get thoughts on Pope Leo XIV from our bishop, and we take you to Mass. HPR was there for last night's special service for the new pontiff. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Layla Ireland comes from a long line of military service. Her father, grandfather, and great-grandfather are all veterans. Ireland herself is a retired Army veteran from Hawaii who is married to a Master Sergeant in the Air Force. Both she and her husband are transgender. Her husband, Logan, is a lead plaintiff in a federal lawsuit seeking to block an executive order issued by President Donald Trump in February that disqualifies trans people from military service. The Supreme Court decided last week that the administration's ban can go into effect, even as multiple legal challenges make their way through the courts. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Layla Ireland about her experience in the military and the current challenges facing trans troops like her husband.
The same rhetoric that is being used against trans people in the military were used for gays in the military, were used for women in combat roles, were used for integrating African Americans into the ranks. And every time that rhetoric was being used, the people have emerged much stronger because they proved that wrong. And so in the military, identifying as both gay and as trans, stark difference. After the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal happened, nothing blew up. The military kept moving. It got even stronger. Folks were able to be themselves, to present as themselves, to bring their families and their loved ones around when they felt they couldn't before, except for trans folks. And so I compare it to having to do Don't Ask, Don't Tell all over again. And that's what it was, which prompted my, not just my transition journey, but also my journey in advocacy for trans people in the military. In regard to open service, with the changing administrations, as we do see every election, it has changed drastically every time. And so under the Obama administration, when it was repealed or it was lifted, and then we had the Biden administration who tried to continue that, the Trump administration during the first term and even the second term have been nothing short of egregious, dangerous. And so what we're seeing now is the harsher side of this implementation of this ban on trans people, and not just in the military, but in society altogether.
How has it felt, especially with this, the policies of trans people serving in the military? How has it felt that it's gone back and forth over the past couple administration changes?
Our service members have given years of their lives to the military. They believe in the mission and the values that they're supposed to stand for. But right now, for the very first time, and maybe not the first time, maybe this is because this is the second term for this administration, the rhetoric, even the decisions that are being made at the government level or even the Supreme Court level, is leaving a lot of our service members and even their families, not just service members and their families, but also our veterans, leaving them feeling a very profound mix of betrayal, grief, maybe even frustration. It's tough to plan forward when everything, whether it's within the military or outside of the military, is literally stacked up against you. These service members, like I have done before and that have come before me, laced up their boots and went to work and did the job that they were trained to do that America demanded, right? They demanded warfighters, they got warfighters. What's happening now, because of the rhetoric that is being used, because of the picture that is trying to be painted in society by our so-called leaders, is leaving are service members feeling like their service is not valued, that it wasn't worthy. There are thousands of service members right now currently serving, some of them abroad in austere environments, that are feeling the heat of feeling unworthy and feeling like they have no way forward, having to make decisions to survive amidst an administration that does not recognize their service. And that's the hard part, to watch that as that unfolds.
So you feel like it is almost a distraction, or it's something that's not relevant to a person's credentials that they're being judged on?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're not only a former service member yourself, but your partner is also a service member currently, and he's trans. And just like, what has that experience been like for you?
Yeah, you know, watching my husband, a service member, a man who has given so much of himself to this country, to his country, sit in the unbearable silence of an uncertain future has been one of the hardest, gut-wrenching experiences in my own life. I've seen the way that he carries on his shoulders the weight of his service and the pride in his eyes when he talks about his brothers and sisters in arms, the fight that he does, the missions that he goes on. Suddenly, when at night, you know, when the walls close in and the uniform that once gave him purpose becomes like a painful reminder of the fight he's being forced to leave behind. And I see the cracks in that. I see the disbelief, the betrayal, the grief of that. Even when he speaks, there's a lot of doubt. And I feel the ache in his heart. I can feel it. I can hear it. I can see it. Right now, we're living in a world that's, it almost seems unreal, right? And all because of who he is. We're being ridiculed and discriminated against because of that. So I think as a spouse, it's really tough to have to help sift through that with him while also simultaneously trying to move forward in life and make sure that we're surviving. There's a lot of unknowns right now. This is all we know. We know the military. We've been in it for so long that this has become so routine for us. And so having to wake up daily and watch him get ready for work, knowing at any given time, they can say, you're done, with no actual evidence of him not being able to perform or being fit or worthy of his position. He is a great leader. He has led many folks during wartime, during peacetime. He's led many folks here in his office and making sure that they are well taken care of. And anyone that he has worked with can speak to his character as a leader, that he needs to be here. He belongs a part of this team, whereas the administration isn't saying otherwise. So that's really tough to watch as a spouse.
I saw that you spoke at Transgender Day of Visibility at Capital Modern. And I wonder, how are you seeing the community here in Hawaii reacting, the community of service members?
The response from the community that I'm getting, whether they're LGBTQ or not, is that they are supportive of open trans service. Because you have to remember, only 1% of the population actually decides to swear an oath to defend the country. And part of that 1%, you have trans people in the military. So a lot of the folks that have an opinion on trans people being in the military have never served. And there's a large percentage of folks that have never served that have this opinion. And to that, I say, you know, even here in Hawaii, we have a huge military population. So there's a lot of that goes around here that it's very well known. Are there a lot of LGBTQ people here in Hawaii as military? Absolutely, because we see them on the weekends or out in parades or participating in sports, all the things. Overwhelmingly, they have been supportive and they see that what's happening is wrong, but they also see everything else that's happening and is wrong, right? So it's not just this story, it's everything else. HIV prevention and funding. You have resources for safe sex out the door. All of these things are being impacted and LGBT people are being blamed and villainized for it. And we're just like, how is this happening? And so, again, I think to answer your question in short, the support is there. We see it. We hear it. It's the folks at the top, that 1% or folks on the Hill that are supposed to represent our state and our country are just not hearing those things.
Is there anything else that you want listeners to know?
That's always the good question at the end, right? Well, what greater proof of patriotism is there than willingly placing one's life in line for a country that too often fails to see our humanity, particularly transgender people in uniform and body, a dedication that transcends personal grievances. And they stand shoulder to shoulder with their fellow service members to defend all those freedoms that we get to enjoy every day. And those freedoms that paradoxically, some would deny them. So their service, our service members now, our trans service members, their service is an act of profound courage, and not only in the face of external threats, but also in the face of institutional policies and societal biases that question their right to wear the uniform. We've been serving for the last 10 years, unwaveringly, and our rap sheets for each of these service members will prove that as well. And so I think before we pass any judgment on that, look at the service members that are in. Look at the folks that are fighting to want to serve and ask yourself, why is it that our administration is wantingly so hard to not allow folks to really just serve the country that they want to? Why are they trying to take that away when we're literally trying to stay in service? Because this is what you've asked for. You've demanded warfighters. We were trained. We've been there. We've done the work. Our rap sheets prove it. Please see us as equals and not as the enemy.
That was retired Army veteran Layla Ireland talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. Ireland works with Sparta, a nonprofit group that advocates for gay and trans rights in the military.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Help shape the future of Hawaii Public Radio. Nominate yourself or someone you know for our Community Advisory Board. As a volunteer, you'll represent your part of the islands and advise HPR on programs and events. Apply by May 16th at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Take HPR with you on the go with the HPR app. Stream us live, read or listen to news stories, or play select programs on demand. Download the free HPR app on iOS or in the Android store.
Negotiations between China and the U.S. have led to a 90-day temporary reduction in President Trump's tariffs. Currently, there is a 30% tariff on goods from China, down from 145%. With few details released on the negotiations, it remains to be seen if a lasting trade agreement is possible between the two countries. So, how are residents and small businesses in Chinatown coping with all this uncertainty? Well, Shulan Schubert Kwok is the founder and president of the Chinatown Business and Community Association. She sat down with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson.
Give us a sense of the temperature in Chinatown. What do you hear from shopkeepers there with regard to the tariffs?
There's a high degree of worry. People worry. Mostly they're worried about not having something to sell in the next few months because the moment they heard about the tariff, and then the next week there was going to be a pause for 90 days, a lot of the merchants, not Hawaii alone, but around the whole world, putting their orders in, rush order to order foodstuff, merchandise for the next half a year if they could. But they have not received any products from China because the whole world is jumping into that order, big order, and the supply cannot match the demand. So now, many of the shopkeepers are thinking, what am I going to do with an empty shop? I have nothing to sell. So they are worried about this. And on top of that, they are not sure, since they put in an order, they're not going to cancel the order. And if the products came late, they're still going to pay for it. But then when the products come in late, the tariffs hit. So how are you going to price these products to make it saleable? So the uncertainty is really eating them up.
And even if they can place big orders, try to get out in front, and even if they do get the orders that they place, like you said, they might still be subjected to the tariffs. And then you run into other issues like storage, right?
Yes.
If you're making big orders, where are you going to put everything?
Right. So a lot of the products are perishable as well. Like, for instance, we have Chinese grocery stores. They have sauces. They have dried goods like noodles, all kinds of ingredients for cooking. All kinds of, maybe in Chinese cooking, you maybe have a few hundred types of ingredients. You know, even you're talking about like chili or bean sauce, there's so many varieties, right? And even noodles, there are hundreds of varieties. So you talk about from beans to all of these, the shelf life of these things, again, you know, they have to find storage spaces. They'll have to see how much they got because it's not guaranteed what they're going to get. They might get less. They might get what they ordered for.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up groceries because the idea behind the tariffs, as it's been explained to the American public by the president, is that it can help create more manufacturing, more production in the U.S. But you're talking about items that are special to Chinese cuisine and specially made in China.
Yeah. So it's, some people view this as a punishment to China and Chinese people ever since COVID was accused of being the Chinese disease. So it's another punitive blow to Chinese people or people of Asian descent. Because I think many people view President Trump as a very vindictive and petty man. So he is also viewed as being very jealous of China's success. You look at the nice apartments they live in, you know, the beautiful train station, the bridges, and they invest money. They not only loan money to African countries and other parts of the world, but they brought the technology to help this country build dams and build water for these people, build electricity, build manufacturing plants, cars. They actually raise the livelihood of these people. They are actually a working capitalist economy, manufacturing 100 times more than we do in the United States. We started doing what we call cheaper labor manufacturing. So we export them to India, we export them to Thailand, we export them to Vietnam, and Mexico were one of the first countries we exported to, and Canada. So once we got that big profit margin from getting cheap labor, we outsourced. That was a couple of decades old philosophy of being smart and getting your stock prices to go up. So the CEO makes like a couple thousand times more money than your middle executive. So the disparity between the rich and the poor is astounding in the United States. We have a lot of billionaires, but we also have a lot of poor people. Can President Trump's policy of reliving the past and making United States great again by manufacturing locally? I don't think so, because you don't have to train people. You don't have people who are like factory workers years ago. They transition and move off or died. The new people are not skilled. You don't have this army of people after the World War II to service these factories. You don't have factories anymore. And the time frame, by the time you set up your factory, the world has gone by. So how can you try to relive that? I think it's too big of a fantasy.
Returning to one of your original points about some more specialty items, you know, let's say I want to start making fish sauce here in the U.S. The marketplace for me isn't going to be the same as it would be for cars, right? Some of these are specialty items that have a market here in the U.S., but it's much more specialized. Who's going to build out
the only manufactured sauce that I can remember and is happening in the United States is by the Vietnamese guy that made the hot sauce. The sriracha sauce. And he got pushed out of his neighborhood. He had to find another place because the people are complaining about the spiciness of the sauce burning their eyes.
Give us some good examples of some products that are staples in some of the shops that we'd see in Chinatown and how the cost has escalated. That bottle of fish sauce, if I bought it a year ago, how much would it have cost me? How much?
About $7 for the 3-crab fish sauce. Now it's $11. So expect 15.
So 11, which is sort of rising inflation. But if we're talking about tacking tariffs on, we're looking at more like 15, yeah. Doubling essentially.
And there's also the mistrust. Yes, the treaties are unequal. Everybody agrees that because we have tried to cultivate China from their communist years into a more humane, into a more democratic, into a more capitalistic country. That was our policy in the 70s. Chou Enlai and Henry Kissinger and Nixon, they recognized China and they said, okay, we're going to help you. We gave them aid, we gave them educational exchange, everything else. We were trying to change their mindset and bring up a new generation of people that are sympathetic to the West to stop the Cold War. But then what happened? They grew and grew and our government went down and down. We can't blame them for their success with our failures because our policy got corrupt. Our government, our Congress stopped working together. Our Congress stopped representing the people who elected them. Our Congress would pay to play. They were not really representing our democracy. The many things that were wrong, the American people sacrificed over their personal well-being. So I think our administration is to blame for our failures. We can't blame other countries that we set our policy to try and rescue and correct and have a peaceful world order and us being big brother. And then we did our missteps. We just slept through the whole thing. And then now we say, okay, I'm the new boss. I'm going to punish you because I don't like you now. This is how people see America is throwing a tantrum and not having a workable policy. Now we're punishing the whole world.
And because we've been slow to realize the changing dynamics.
Yeah, we've been sleeping the last 5 decades.
I know within the small business community in Chinatown, there was some support for President Trump when he was a candidate. Is that support still
there? Most of my business people voted for him. Everybody said, we want to change. We want lower taxes. We want lower prices. We want to have more savings because he's going to cut taxes. He promised a lot of things that are what we want, what we really want. Of course, they vote for him. And also because he was a businessman. He was not a career politician. So that was his attraction to a lot of people. They think about Trump, the brand. You know, they of course didn't look into his 5 bankruptcies and how he cheated people and how he cheated with everything like University of Trump. People don't see that part of him. They see this guy on TV, you know, having his apprentice show, having the Miss Universe, having all this glamorous life with his name all over the place. So, of course, they vote for him.
And so how are people feeling now, a few months into the presidency and with the tariffs?
It's just like you promised your child on his birthday, he's going to get this and this. Then the birthday came and the child came up and looked at you and you delivered nothing. That's what they feel. Big disappointment. But this is his second term. He couldn't care less. He's etched his name in history. He came back and he won. So it was like, hey, I have nothing to lose. I can do whatever I want.
Is there any sense within the communities of Chinatown that you're familiar with that this is something beyond economic confrontation? I mean, you spoke to this a little bit, but does it feel like a broader cultural confrontation?
I think there's a hatred. China was his target from the time of COVID, and he never let go. I mean, there was such a dark period in American history where Asian people were attacked on the subway, in the supermarket, in the parks. We used to be the government where people look up to. People look at the Statue of Liberty as a hope for the entire country, an entire universe that people said, if I want a better life, I will go to America. I will start my life anew. We'll have a new beginning because America is a land of hope and the land of dreams, the land of those who want to work for that dream. And now we have insanity.
What are some of the other forces that are bearing down on small business owners in Chinatown? Not just the tariffs, but there are other considerations, I know, in terms of rent and insurance and so forth.
Well, yeah, you hit the point on the insurance because ever since Maui fire, a lot of property owners, now our buildings are old. Most of our buildings were built in the 1920s. For buildings like this, the older the building with no fire sprinklers, going to cost more. So the landlord will pass on the cost. And the electricity in most buildings are actually billed to the owner. And usually they don't spend the money to sub-meter. They just slap a gross rent on it. So if the property taxes, insurance, and the camp charges, camp means common area, you know, maintenance, go up, your rent go up. We finally just got off our feet from recovering on COVID, number one. And number two, a larger part of homeless population left to go to shelters, which is a blessing because of the Blangetti administration.
You're describing a neighborhood that went through a lot, particularly in the last few years with COVID and all of the considerations that it raised, and just finding its footing and getting back on track.
And then we get wham, bam.
Yeah,
with hit the tariffs. By the tariffs. Yeah.
So let me ask you, if the tariffs last several months or say a year, what does the future of Chinatown look like?
Actually, it's a very good question, because right now we are almost 97% fully rented. The public housing, you know, with assisted housing and all of that are all full. Many of the anchor businesses are run by second, third generation people. I think some of it will die down, or we will have to depend on tourists.
You mentioned it feeling like there was a target on on China and Chinese people.
Yes.
Well, so if people are feeling like they have a target on them, feeling like the situation is becoming unmanageable, are people thinking about leaving the States, and let's say specifically leaving Hawaii?
I think a lot of well-educated Chinese people, because in China, you can have dual citizenship. Even those people here with green card, they haven't given up their citizenship, or those who are naturalized, they can go home and start a new life with their new experience. We're going to have a brain drain for sure.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me.
You're welcome.
That was HBR's D.W. Gibson and Shulan Schubert Kwok talking about how uncertainty around the tariffs has been affecting communities in that downtown neighborhood. Schubert Kwok invited Gibson to join her in Chinatown to meet a few small business owners and hear about their experiences with the tariffs.
Our first stop was Guanhua. It's a gift shop run by a woman named Linda. It's one of two shops that Linda and her husband operate on Mauna Kea Street. Linda talked about slowing business, the difficulty of keeping her stores stocked with new products, and the possibility that one of the two stores might have to close.
Hello? Hey, Linda. Linda, you're
in. How long has the shop been open?
21 years old.
21 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Her English is good when she wants to answer, yeah? She ordered. They're taking advantage of the 90 day, but nothing came yet.
Still waiting for it to arrive.
Yeah, waiting.
If she has product, then she can sell. If not, she has no products, she has to close shop because she can't pay rent and no products. Mm. So she'll move to her other shop.
Yeah.
We don't want old inventory. For the new year stuff, gotta go, right? So you gotta sell out. Otherwise, you don't have fresh inventory. If the shipments are not coming, you have nothing to sell. So you always have discount after like Christmas sale or New Year sale. So you move your products, so new stuff come in. People show interest. They don't buy the same old stuff, right?
Yeah.
You got new products, new design, new things.
But that's what she's waiting for.
Yes, but not coming yet.
Yeah.
Because everybody is ordering, right? So everybody trying to take advantage of 90-day pause.
So how is she feeling in general? How is she feeling about
it? Isn't that like pressure, ma?
She
has no money to buy. So
yeah,
high-end products
not just hard to sell, yeah.
Yeah, so it's that worry we talk about, not wanting to spend money when you're not sure about the future.
So it's been really slow in here?
Yes, slow,
yes.
Slow. Then you have to pay electricity, pay your rent, you still have to eat, pay tax, you still have to pay employees, your insurance, you have to pay. So Trump's policy is very harmful. Trump's jealous, not happy.
Does she agree with you that he's a little jealous of China?
Yeah, some of the Trump and they just want to do business. They don't want to get into the politics.
Makes sense.
Next, we popped into Yupo Noodles, a restaurant that Andrew Pressler opened at the beginning of the year. I talked to Andrew about how the tariffs are putting more pressure on the small profit margins that define the restaurant business.
Hey, welcome to Chinatown. You are the only white boy having a noodle shop in Chinatown.
So you just opened recently?
About 5 months ago, yeah.
So how's it going so far?
So far it's great.
So have you run into any issues in terms of pricing of products related to tariffs?
Yeah, for sure. I get a lot of my ingredients from a Chinese wholesale company, and they've definitely seen well, which therefore makes my prices go up for sure. Yeah, it's definitely a big concern for everybody who, you know, uses anything that comes out of China, Taiwan, Hong Kong. Like even things like
the
fish
sauces. All your sauces and
things like fish sauce. There are things like all of our, you know, the things that we use, you know, the containers we use for takeout, the things that we use to store things in. You know what I mean? All those things come from elsewhere. None of those things come from here in the U.S. Those things going out. So all of our menu pricing is going to have to go up to account for it. So it's going to end up hurting us and hurting the consumers as well. the restaurant business is already a spot where margins are very slim. It's difficult to turn a profit in the restaurant business to begin with. And this is definitely not helping things. It's also, you know, if the perception is that eating out or, you know, getting takeout or whatnot, like, can we do quite a bit of takeout business, is too expensive, then that's definitely going to hurt us.
Our last stop was in one of the larger grocery stores on Mauna Kea Street. It's usually bustling with customers, but it was quiet when we arrived. Chulon introduced me to Jack. He's the third generation in his family to run the shop.
So tell me, have the tariffs affected your business here at all?
Oh, absolutely. We're having shortage on the supplies, and then the price is about 20% higher right now. It's going to get more than 20%. I'll say, the tariff is 145%, and then... Yeah, and it's really affecting our supply. And then we're not getting any shipments at all starting now.
So that problem with shipments just started, huh?
Yes, starting from end of March. Yeah, beginning April. Yeah, actually.
And so those extra costs with tariffs, are those something you're having to pass on to customers?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we have a 20% increase on almost every item, and it's going to get more than 20%. So I'll say about 50% at least.
How are customers reacting to that reality?
They're real mad about this price increase, and they're getting less and less because the price is getting higher and higher. Yeah, so we're like getting less customer coming in, and then even regular customer not coming in at all. Yeah, it's been so slow.
Tell me a little bit about how long the shop has been here in your family.
Yeah, I'm the third generation, actually. We have been here for 48 years since my grandfather started this store in 1977. I haven't seen even the pandemic. It's not this bad. This terror is getting worse and worse.
I was going to ask about the pandemic. You feel like this is even worse than what you experienced in 2020, 2021?
Yes, yes. Pandemic is just for a short period of time, and now we don't know when is it going to end. That's the main problem.
Any adjustments you're making for the future in terms of trying to plan? Any switches in the business model?
Probably we were trying to get supplies from elsewhere, but it's not working. Yeah, it seems everywhere the price increase, every supplier. So they're on a way out. Just going to be bare with the shortage of supply.
That was Shulon Schubert Kwok with HBR's G.W. Gibson. They were talking with small business owners in Chinatown. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. To mark the year of our community forests, we're partnering with Trees for Honolulu's Future to bring you trivia based on native plants. Today, the official state flower of Hawaii is the yellow hibiscus, but another plant held the title of national plant in the days of the kingdom. Also in the hibiscus family, this native plant has much smaller flowers, which are soft and fragile. And this plant loves the full sun and can grow into bushes up to 10 feet high. Their height gives them an advantage for getting sunlight when they grow inland. And near the shore, they're protected from the strong winds by their prostrate form. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, can you name this former national plant? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HBR tote bag and a brand new deck of Trees for Honolulu's Futures card game, Kumulaau. Mm-hmm.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, we've recently featured how President Donald Trump's executive orders have impacted federal grants to places like Bishop Museum. Today, HBR reporter Cassie Ardonio joins us live in the studio to look at what arts organizations in our community are grappling with. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, when we talked to Bishop, I know they had money from the Institute for Museums and Libraries. They had money from the National Endowment of the Arts and from the Humanities and the Science Foundation. So it's a big hit, potentially, that they're grappling with. So what did you find in your reporting?
I did find that there were several organizations that received the letter from the National Endowment for the Arts on May 2nd that their grants were canceled. So we have Bishop Museum, like you just interviewed them. They had their grants from the NEA canceled. The Asia Pacific Dance Festival, the Hawaii International Film Festival also got their grants canceled and had a reduction of 20% in their operating budget, which is about a little over $1 million annually. And then also Hawaii Contemporary also had their grants canceled by the NEA. And Hawaii Contemporary is are the nonprofit folks that organize the triennial, all the artworks that we're seeing across the state. So I spoke with them, and they're pretty much worried about the future of funding these festivals or these these community events for the public. So everyone's pretty much scrambling to, you know, fill in those gaps. Some organizations are going into the red, but they actually do have a chance to appeal the cancellation of the grants. Here's Sheen Ru Young of the Asia Pacific Dance Festival, and she says that the NEA gave her that option.
When they say appeal, they want us to prove that we are now, that our project fits the new administration's priorities. This is incredibly concerning to me because it says that the government, or I guess the administration, is telling us what we can make art about and who we need to make it for. And if we don't fit their new agenda, then we will be canceled. And I think that's a really slippery slope that we're on right now. We did appeal, and I believe that's what we need to do in order to, you know, continue to see through our end of things. But honestly, there's talk of this being a violation of federal regulation, because anytime you cancel or terminate a grant, that can only be if the awardee is non-compliant. But none of the people who have had their awards canceled have been non-compliant. They're actually asking that we either fulfill their new agenda, which is not what we submitted this application based on, or, you know, termination or rescinding. So it really concerns me because I feel like that's just one step away from censorship, or I guess creating the propaganda for a new agenda. And then on the state level, honestly, it's a really, really, really detrimental if the NEA is dismantled, because there's so much that the state does and funds that's based on cost sharing. And if there isn't the national funding available, then the state also cannot have access to those funds, and they can't support the local organizations that are coming to them and submitting proposals or requests for proposals.
Yeah, because you think, gosh, freedom of expression, you know, First Amendment rights, and it is like it's being stifled.
Yeah, and these grant cancellations are pretty significant for arts organizations. And like Sheen Ru Young was saying, $25,000 is not a small amount. Those grant monies from the federal agency fund staff positions and operational costs, and making sure like the artists that they contracted out are making sure they're getting paid and not doing free labor. And, you know, the NEA has funded 38 projects in Hawaii between 2023 and 2025, and that's totaling more than $3 million. $1,000. So that's definitely not a small amount. And the NEA grants for the arts typically range from $10,000 to $100,000 issued twice a year. And going back in time, this is not the first time that the Trump administration has proposed to cut the NEA. He made that proposal during his first term in office in 2016, but that proposal was roundly rejected by Congress on a bipartisan basis. And that resulted in the agency actually receiving a funding increase. And even going back in, more in time, in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan's administration also proposed to slice the NEA and the NEH. Here's Michael Cowell, who is a teaching artist who runs the his business called Drama Crew, and he says arts has always been on the chopping block for as long as he can remember.
This has been a continual idea of, wait a second, if you're going to put a painting on a wall, you should buy the painting. It should be the person that buys the painting, and they should be able to support it. This idea that public funding should not be used to fund the arts has been around for a long, long time. But the mark of a great society is how well we do fund the arts, because it's only through the arts that we're remembered. When you go to Italy and you visit Rome, you're not going just to eat the food. By the way, that's culinary arts. You're going to see the architecture and the arts. You're going inside the museums and the churches to see their art. When people come to Hawaii, they want to see dance. They want to hear the music. They want to see the fashion. They want to eat the food of Hawaii'i. And those are all the arts. You can't separate business and culture and life. It's all together. We're one.
Yeah, and I know that the state had stepped in to try and challenge the funding for the Institute for Museums and Libraries, but who's going to bat for the arts?
It's still a wait and see. I do know that the lawsuit pending on the NEH grants are being canceled, and that was there was another lawsuit regarding gender ideology restrictions on the NEA funding, but that judge ruled that it cannot be a condition of receiving grants.
Okay, all right. Well, just lots of uncertainty out there. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonia. Look for her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Now it's time to uproot the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a plant that was designed as a national flower during the days of the Hawaiian Kingdom. It's a good one for beginning gardeners because it germinates easily and the seedlings grow quickly. The flowers of the plant have five petals, are often yellow, but can be orange or even a dull red color. These flowers can be strung in delay or used to add color to your salad. But a warning, they are a mild laxative that can be used to ease the upset stomach of babies. So what's the name of this former national star? We were looking for the alima. That was the answer that Alex Tronovich from Kula Maui, he knew the answer because he works at Native Nursery. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Catholics across the globe and here in Hawaii are praying for the new head of the church. Pope Leo XIV is the first American pope, and in Kalihi last night, parishioners gathered to celebrate a mass in his honor. In his sermon, Bishop Larry Silva spoke of the intense analysis about who this new cardinal from the south side of Chicago is and what he may or may not do as the head of the church. Will he continue to focus on immigrants and the working class? Will he or won't he help to elevate women? What will be his legacy?
I believe this missionary pope is a great blessing to us and a great challenge to us as well, to remind us that going out is always our call as disciples of Jesus. Yes, certainly he has his role and it's very important, but the Church of Jesus Christ is not just one person. It is all of us united, different, with different gifts, different opinions, different ways of looking at things, but united as one body so that we can proclaim that Jesus Christ is risen, is present, is loving us today, is wanting to bring his peace and breathe out that peace upon the world. And so this missionary pope is a symbol for us to also go out to all the world and preach the good news. It is important that we not only imitate him, though, but that we pray for him. And of course, he is included in every Eucharistic prayer we pray, but it is important that we lift him up in prayer because this is a burdensome office. It is not easy to be the pastor of the whole world.
And we sat down with Bishop Larry Silva just before Mass. He and a delegation from Hawaii had been planning to visit the Vatican in October to mark the Jubilee Year of the Church. And Bishop Silva plans to invite Pope Leo to Hawaii to celebrate the first arrival or the arrival of the first Catholic missionaries here in the islands.
Every 25 years, the Church celebrates the Jubilee of Christ's birth. And so this is being 2025, it is a jubilee of hope. And so Pope Francis, of course, started it and opened the holy doors. So we are going with the group from Hawaii, and hopefully it's still open. We can still take signups, but this group will visit the Vatican and other places in Rome. We'll go through the holy door and pray there. We will also go to Siena and to Vinci, where Leonardo da Vinci was from. So it should be a wonderful trip.
So I understand, though, you were planning to extend an invitation for the Pope to come and celebrate with us in 2027?
Yes. So in 2027, we will be celebrating the bicentennial of the arrival of the first Catholic missionaries in Hawaii. After much consultation, I decided to go ahead and invite the Pope to come for this celebration. The main date is July, that's when they arrive, but if the Pope does come and his schedule says I can come in May and not July, then we'll switch it to May. So hopefully he will be able to come and maybe even visit some of the other Pacific Islands as well. I don't know that a Pope has recently been to many of these islands. I think John Paul II went to Guam and maybe Samoa.
Well, in all your years with the Church, did you ever think that we would have a Pope from America?
No, I didn't think so. No, I didn't think that would happen. But, you know, God is full of surprises, so thanks be to God for him. You know, I think it's a great source of pride for us who are here in the United States. But on the other hand, I mean, it's not because he's an American that we're celebrating, but because he has a lot of pastoral experience throughout the world. I think he's a man of the world. As the head of the Augustinian order for 12 years, he traveled all over the world, saw many faces of the Church, and so I think that's a great enriching experience. And he was a bishop in Peru, so he has pastoral experience as well. And for the past 2 years, he was the prefect for the Congregation for Bishops, so was vetting bishops and bishop candidates all over the world. So again, he has lots of international exposure. And so that's, of course, a great thing for the Pope. Plus, he has lived in Rome for at least 14 years that I'm aware of, 12 as the Superior General of the Augustinians and the last two as the prefect for the Dicastery for Bishops. So he knows that church as well, and as the Bishop of Rome, I think that's very important as well.
Did your path ever cross at all?
No, unfortunately, I have not yet met him. I hope to perhaps in October, but yes, I haven't had the good fortune of meeting him yet.
Well, the stories that are coming out are very endearing of him, you know, as a child playing priest and One thing I heard was that, you know, they used their mother's ironing board and they threw a sheet over it and they, right. they yes. went to mass.
Right. Yeah, so I did that too. I had a lunch pail tabernacle and, you know, my vestments made out of an old sheet and the altar linens and so on. So, yeah, I think that's little boys play things, and I think that's a good thing that hopefully they will come into the priesthood.
Yeah, it's a little role-playing,
yeah.
But you share something in common.
Yes, yes, indeed.
What are you hopeful for with this new pope, with Pope Leo, and what he might do for Catholics across this country?
I would hope that he would help us be more of a missionary church. And of course, that was Francis's emphasis as well, but I would hope that he would help us find concrete ways to reach out to those who do not know Jesus yet, and to come to know him and to love him and to know how much he loves them, and to come into the church to experience his presence with us, especially in the Eucharist. So that would be my hope, and the indications so far are that that is a great priority of his too. And with his missionary background, you know, an American serving in Peru and Latin America, that's a great sign for us.
What would you like our listeners to know and remember as we come across this bicentennial, you know, of the arrival of the first Catholic missionaries? I mean, I know as I drive around in my neighborhood, right, Bachelot, you know, all names of priests who served here in Hawaii.
Yes. Well, they came to preach the good news of Jesus, and to bring together people who would form a community of the body of Christ. And they were very successful in that endeavor, I would say. But we have new missionary challenges now, and it's not necessarily to go overseas, but to reach out to those who are our family members, our neighbors, our friends, to be missionaries to them, to tell them the good news of Jesus, and to invite them to come and experience the love of the Lord.
What do you think the first thing when you meet the new pope, what would you say to him?
If I were to meet him today, I would congratulate him and tell him that I am praying for him. He certainly will lead all of our prayers, and that's why we're gathered here at the Co-Cathedral tonight, to pray for him. It's a very tough job, and whatever support we can give him, I think, is very important.
And yeah, we will keep our fingers crossed and hope that his calendar is open in 2027.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Well, thank you so much,
thank
Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you very much. God bless you.
That was Bishop Larry Silva, who presided over a special mass in honor of Pope Leo XIV. It was held last night at St. Teresa's in Kalihi. Silva has been the bishop of the diocese for 20 years, and this month marks his 50th year in the church. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow we plan to hear from a Zen master whose book could help us all during these trying times. When No Thing Works is the title. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.